Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, so let's dive into the week in review, starting with racism, the Red Sox, and what Baltimore Orioles center fielder Adam Jones says he heard from the stands on Monday night.
I heard the N-word, and I get certain reactions when, you know, someone says something clever or says something really, really stupid and ignorant. And last night, it was not clever. It was really stupid and ignorant.
Red Sox president Sam Kennedy agreed and apologized in an interview on WEEI.
I want to be very clear. We take Adam Jones at his word, and that is unacceptable for what happened, and we're going to take steps to address it.
Massachusetts politicians weighed in. Here's Governor Charlie Baker.
There's no place for this in society. There's no place for it in sports. It shouldn't be tolerated.
But part of the problem is, not everyone thinks there's a problem, like former Sox pitcher Curt Schilling.
Do I think it was faked? As of today, yes. Certainly doesn't mean I don't believe there isn't racism, but I don't believe that happened.
This as another racially charged incident on Tuesday night ended with a fan ejected from the game and barred for life from Fenway Park. Well, lots to discuss here, so let's do that with Reverend Mariama White-Hammond. She's an associate minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, an activist and an organizer. Reverend White-Hammond, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us this week, Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. Charlie, it's good to have you back as well.
Good to be here. Thank you.
All right, so from Reverend White-Hammond, let me just start with you and get your reaction to the considerable tumult and controversy in terms of what happened at Fenway Park this week.
So I guess I can start by saying I'm not exactly surprised. I'm not surprised that it happened. I'm not surprised by sort of the sort of range of reactions that sort of folks have had. To be honest, you know, I grew up here in Boston my whole life. And the reality is there is a history around the Red Sox, and the Red Sox being a baseball team that was not willing to integrate for quite a long time.
Yeah.
The last team to integrate.
Yeah.
In Major League Baseball, exactly.
Yeah. And growing up, you know, as a, you know, black person living in Boston, you know, we didn't always cheer for the Sox. We weren't necessarily against the Sox, but I did not grow up with the culture that the Sox were our team sometimes, because I think there's still a, you know, there's a tension in the in the black community about that. On the flip side, the Celtics, which you would think, you know, their mascot is not definitely, you know, I didn't think about the irony of that until someone not from Boston sort of pointed out. But we did have a strong relationship, or a different sense. So, you know, I'm not saying that the Red Sox haven't come a long way, but I do think it's important to be honest about our history, and to question the ways in which that history continues to play itself out. So, you know, I believe Adam Jones. I've lived in the city. I've seen it and heard it happen before, so I don't think it's impossible.
So, Charlie, before I come to you here, I want to play a couple of pieces of tape that just dovetail with what Reverend White-Hammond was saying, because this week we spoke with Howard Bryant, ESPN columnist and also NPR correspondent. You know, and he was talking about that history of the Red Sox and race, and he mentioned that the Red Sox didn't sign a black free agent until 1992.
When you're signing a free agent, you have the black player who has to choose to come here. And free agency began in 1975. So between 1975 and 1992, not a single black person who played Major League Baseball chose to come to Boston.
We also talked with WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, and she talked with us about that broader history that you were mentioning. The last team to integrate in Major League Baseball, not signing Jackie Robinson, Tom Yawkey's own racist legacy.
Right.
So she mentioned that, like, this is why this story is so important to talk about right now, because it actually goes far beyond just the Red Sox.
I can remember a player that I covered, Mo Vaughn, talking to high school students about racism that he experienced. And I mean, it's not just the Red Sox, too. It goes out to the broader city. I mean, you think of, you know, African-American athletes, professional athletes who called Boston home, a legendary player like Bill Russell experiencing, you know, racism in this city.
Charlie Chipio, you know, on the other hand, I've been getting emails from people this week who've been saying, yes, but Boston's also come a long way. So you can't talk about it like we're still the Boston of the 1970s. That's some reaction I've been getting from folks.
Well, you know, it's funny. I wanted to hope Boston had come a long way, too. And I think the thing that really more than anything else, or as much as any of this horrible stuff, made my heart sink was when I heard, you know, and now I can't remember the name, if it's another current player or a former player who was African-American, made a statement to when asked about it in the media saying, oh, yeah, when I was playing, you know, it was always worse in Boston than it was anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I really had hoped that we were beyond that. You know, you want to think that, you know, somebody gets drunk in the stands and they act like an idiot or something. But when I heard that, it just really drove home to me how systemic it is. And it's just very sad.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think the challenge that I find is that two things could be true at the same time. Yes, we have come a long way. At the same time, we have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. And people are acting like, you know, racism is like some, you know, disease that like you just get rid of it and then it's over. It's a chronic condition that maybe, I think it definitely has improved in the city. But we still are a long way to go to that place. And that's true. I mean, I think it's not just the Red Sox. It is really hard, not just for sports teams, but for companies to attract people here because there's a reputation. Now, some of it is that we're terrible in the way we are at sports games, period. Yeah. There have been times, husband is a Celtics, you know, ticket holder. There have been times where I've seen people who, you know, had a LA Lakers shirt on, and I literally was concerned that they might get attacked. So there's
got to restrain him,
right? You know, so some of it is we could be better about our fan culture, period. But I still think we have a long way to go about race, and I think my concern is if we can't acknowledge it, then we actually then don't address it. But I'm heartened by what the Red Sox organization did.
Right.
But I think we as a community still have a ways to go.
Yeah, so, and I do think that is just worth mentioning that the Red Sox really did do the right thing. They went and they apologized publicly. They went and they talked to Jones privately. They apologized to the Orioles ownership and their management. So one small, I think, positive here is that the Red Sox certainly did handle it well.
Well, to that point, let's hear some tape from Red Sox president Sam Kennedy. This was on Wednesday, when they announced that they had actually banned a fan for life from Fenway Park because of comments that this fan made about the woman who sang the national anthem that night. Again, here's Sam Kennedy.
Today, I feel more a sense of sadness, just deep remorse that these things happen in our society. But it's the reality of the world that we live in. And it's incumbent upon those of us in leadership positions to deal with them, tackle them head on, address them, and work together to try and stamp them out so they don't happen again.
Okay, so that's Sam Kennedy speaking for the Red Sox organization. But, you know, one of the many reasons why this problem is not going to go away, I mean, it goes back to what both of you were saying, and that is that, you know, racism isn't something that you just take a pill for and like, you're cured of. And also, let's be honest, there are a lot of people who are saying that they don't think that there is a problem right now.
Oh, sure.
And I'm just going to play this tape. This is Curt Schilling yesterday on his Breitbart radio show, former Sox pitcher. He thinks that Adam Jones is lying.
I believe Adam Jones made up the story about a fan calling him the N-word. There's a lot of reasons why I believe that. Number one is we live in iPhone age, and we're in Boston, the liberal capital of the world. If anybody was within earshot of that person, we would have heard about it. We would have seen it. We would have seen that person on CNN telling them that, yes, he did. Yes, he did. He was a Republican. He was wearing a Trump T-shirt, blah, 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 blah.
To be honest, that was the mild stuff. So, Reverend White Hammond, I mean, this is the other conversation that's going on right now, and it just makes me wonder. The Red Sox can say what they say; they can take the leadership position that they want to take, but this subculture isn't necessarily that Schilling represents isn't necessarily very sub, right?
No, it's not. And I have to be honest, I go back and forth. but sometimes I'm at least glad that people are being honest about what they think. You know, I do think I've seen over the last, you know, year or so, it's become increasingly acceptable to say things, to deny racism, to even say openly bigoted or sexist things. And that is certainly something worth being concerned about. I don't want people to believe that this just started in Boston, you know, in the last year, because this is something I've been hearing from people my whole life. When I went to school in California, people were like, what is it like to be black in Boston, right? The negative image of who we are is really much larger, you know, and it's been happening for a while. That being said, I do find it concerning that it's become really acceptable. And I guess the question for me is, how do we have these deeper conversations? Mm. Because, you know, Kurt Schilling and I are probably not sitting with each other at the same time. He has one audience. There's probably another audience that's listening here. And then what I find is that these two groups are getting more and more sort of splintered in terms of their perspective of what's even going on in the world. And that's what I think is really dangerous, is when you have people with actually radically different concepts of what is even happening, it's hard to get on the same page. So I do think, yeah, this happened. It's a Boston thing, but there's also a much larger context in our society that needs to be addressed. And right now, I don't see it being addressed in a way that's actually making us move anywhere.
I just scratch my head and I think, was Kurt Schilling this crazy when he was playing? Did we just overlook it because he won games? I mean,
possibly.
This is not exactly new for him. This is at least for the last 3 years.
Well, last 3 years or so. But I mean, this is a guy who kind of seems to be unraveling before our eyes, but that's another story.
You know, I'm going to move on to healthcare here in just a second, but Reverend White Hammond, want to loop back briefly to something you said a couple minutes ago, that when you were growing up, you didn't really feel like the Red Sox were your team. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, given that, like, what was the conversation amongst your congregation like, or member, if you've been in touch with members of your congregation this week about what happened at Fenway Park?
Well, we haven't had a big service, but I've had a conversation with some people. I mean, I think a lot of people, to be honest with you, are just kind of not surprised. Yeah. And that's why, you know, again, most black people that I talked to weren't not happy, but they weren't incensed because they weren't surprised. And so I think that speaks to the fact that this is not an isolated an incident. We have a problem in the city. And until, again, we can admit that, we can't address it.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to another major piece of news to tackle this week. this has to do with healthcare, of course, because just yesterday, the House of Representatives did pass 217 to 213, that margin of 4 votes. The GOP planned to repeal and replace significant parts of the Affordable Care Act. Every House Democrat voted against the bill. 20 House Republicans also voted against the bill. President Donald Trump, nevertheless, because of the passage, spoke at a press conference and celebrated the Republican plan.
It's been a catastrophe, and this is a great plan. I actually think it will get even better. And this is, make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake.
The catastrophe that he was referring to, he believes, is Obamacare. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark spoke to us yesterday after the vote, and she pushed back.
We are going to continue to tell the American people what is in this bill and how it turns the clock back on millions of Americans who have gained access to coverage for pre-existing conditions, gotten rid of lifetime caps. This bill is just fraught with peril for American families.
Charlie, this bill faces also some considerable opposition in the Senate. But I have to say, we can dig into the particular aspects of the bill and the impact it's going to have in this state. But writ large, there's no CBO score on this.
Yeah,
they really
bingo.
Pushed.
First thing I was going to say.
They really pushed it through. I mean, once we have a better sense beyond what we already know about the impact this bill is going to have, it's hard for me to imagine that it's not going to have. There's not going to be some kind of blowback on the Republican Party.
Well, I would certainly think there would be. I did hear someone today saying, sort of trying to break it down and saying, look, we have gotten into this crazy world because, you know, I do think that redistricting is at the base of all our over-polarization in politics, that so many of these Republicans are in districts that are so safe right now that it almost doesn't matter. Now, that just, maybe I'm behind the times, that just doesn't resonate with me. I can't imagine that that's true. I've got to think that there are some who aren't that way. But, you know, the bigger issue here to me is that, boy, if there was ever an issue not to play politics on, we got real problems here. First of all, for any bill to try to address this issue when you have states like Massachusetts where almost everybody has insurance, but it's the most expensive insurance in America. Other states where you have massive, you know, percentages of people who don't have insurance, the issues, the problems are so different from state to state. It's a daunting challenge. And look, the reality here, in my view, is that Obamacare is very problematic. You know, I think we couldn't afford it on many levels, and that we and that you did have the last provider threatening to pull out in certain states and things like that. So it needs a serious response, and this was not a serious response.
Well, to your point about the differences in coverage and plans from state to state, in fact, that's something that House Speaker Paul Ryan spoke about yesterday in the Rose Garden press conference that Republican leaders gave following the passage of the bill. And here's what he said about what the health care law could bring to American families.
We have to repeal this law and put in place a real vibrant marketplace with competition and lower premiums for families. That's what the American Health Care Act is all about. It makes health care more affordable. It takes care of our most vulnerable, and it shifts power from Washington back to the states, and most importantly, back to you, the patient.
Well, in the hour after the bill passed the House, though, we spoke with Jonathan Gruber. He advised President Obama on the Affordable Care Act, and here's how he responded to Speaker Ryan.
On every single count, he's wrong. There's nothing in this law that would increase competition. There's nothing in this law that increases choice.
Reverend White Hammond, your take?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the first thing to remember is that the Affordable Care Act was supposed to be a start, and it was supposed to be continued. That's how they even announced it, and then it just never got continued, right? So I think that's important to think about. I think the second thing is that we are on this crash course to disaster. I mean, I was an executive director of a nonprofit, and I remember when I first started buying health insurance. And, you know, I found some plans that were decent. By the time I left 14 years later, I mean, I was afraid to open the envelope when it came in the mail. And so there's two things that I think people want. They want quality, and they want affordable cost.
Right.
And I don't think we're having a serious conversation about how we balance those things in a real way. And so I think this bill, I haven't read all of it. I'm guessing probably most of the people who voted for it didn't either. But that being said, unless it can deliver on that, I am inclined to believe it's only going to make us be in a worse situation than we are before.
Yeah, I mean, just to jump in here, I take all your points, but I mean, maybe this is just politics, but folks like Paul Ryan and the president and House GOP leadership say that that's what they think this bill delivers exactly, is quality and a lower cost. That's their claim.
Yeah, no, I'm not really so. You know, here's the thing. They may address cost, maybe. But from what I've seen, most of the things seem to be about removing coverage to lower costs. So that the question of quality, I just don't even see how they would claim that they
and even with the
that.
Cost that removes costs on the front end, but it results in bad back public health costs. Outcomes.
Right.
Outcomes
yeah.
That
if are people don't cost have prenatal care,
right.
Someone ends up paying for it somehow.
Yeah.
Exactly. So to that point, let's listen to Dr. Don Berwick. He used to run the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. He's of course here in Massachusetts now. He talked about the impacts on those large programs and the impacts the law could potentially, well, I should say the bill, it's not yet law, the bill could have here in Massachusetts.
This law takes almost $1 trillion away from Medicaid. It also seriously hurts lower income elders. We're looking at major, major increases in health premiums for people age 60, 62, 63. in Massachusetts, it did pull the rug out from under a lot of the very terrific improvements we're making in Medicaid coverage. We could end up holding a bag for $1 billion or $2 billion of care that we have no other coverage for.
You know, and yesterday, Charlie, Martha Biebinger, our fabulous health policy reporter here, told us that we're looking at a situation that if we can't cover those $1 to $2 billion, and I don't know where that money is coming from, that we could see a situation where the amount of coverage in Massachusetts rolls back to pre-2006 levels, that we could essentially undo.
I really want to address that because this is really important. You know, first of all, the thing that we all have to remember is that before yesterday, we got this word that revenues were below expectations in April, and essentially
by $500 million.
Right, essentially, following this pattern in which we are in the macro sense in a good economy with full employment. And every year since Governor Baker's been in office, he's had to make emergency cuts. I mean, if that is not like a flashing light saying, you know, we don't know how we're going to be able to deal with the next downturn aside from this, okay, if things are so bad during what is generally a good economy, you know, you add trying to find $1 to $2 billion, this is problematic. The only bright side is that nothing that looks like this is going to become law.
Well, I think so. I think a couple things. One, I think the American people need to know that there were massive tax cuts that were part of this law, and who benefited from those tax cuts. So while we are all getting less, support for our health care, some of Donald Trump's friends are getting a tax break. So I think that needs to become clear. The second thing is, I really wonder if this is a political calculation. You know, you have a lot of people in the House who are running again in 2 years, right? But you have a lot of senators who are in safer positions. I wonder if they said, we've got to get something through the House so those people can claim victory, and then you let it fall apart in the Senate, where people have less sort of danger of getting in trouble.
Well, the House members can just blame it on them.
Right. We did it. We passed it, but it's those crazy senators.
We got something done. They stopped it. Exactly.
Right.
I mean,
I think if it really goes through, and once people go to the doctor and coverage that they had yesterday, they don't have today, I'm not sure that that's a safe thing for the Republican Party to do.
Yeah, so here's the thing. I mean, I accept that lots of very passionate, good-willed members of the House genuinely have reasons why they want smaller government, for example. And a lot of those reasons are really good. But on the other hand, to use something like healthcare to achieve those goals, or to say, at least tell your constituents, look, we put forth this plan to achieve that goal, when one of the outcomes, for example, of the plan is, in some states, if you're, you know, in your early 60s and you're making $40,000 a year, your insurance fees could go up $12,000 a year because of this proposal. I just don't understand how those two things meet in good conscience when a representative has to go back to his or her district.
You know, I don't know, because you're right. I mean, look, there are many things that they talk about that I agree with. God, the healthcare sector desperately needs some competition. It desperately needs transparency so that people can have a reason to go out and search for the highest value services, you know, at the lowest cost. You know, at Pioneer, we've just done this whole series. Barbara Anthony has just done this whole series of studies that shows there's essentially no correlation between price and quality. Mm-hmm. And there's this massive price variation.
Especially in Massachusetts, right?
You know, those are all good ideas, but this doesn't look like that to me.
Yeah. Well, okay, so everyone take a deep breath, because since it is Friday, I do want to just end the week in review with our hubbubs, a little something, hopefully put a smile on our faces, because the news can be heavy on weeks like this. And Charlie, you want to start us with your hubbub?
Yes, mine is though very grave information. The world's last white male northern rhino is now on Tinder, in case you hadn't seen that. A Kenyan Nature Conservancy created a profile for him on the site, which bills him as the most eligible bachelor in the world. And on the profile, the rhino named Sudan assures us that he performs well under pressure. he currently lives with two other female rhinos, and the goal of this whole Tinder thing. The Tinder and the Nature and the Conservancy are trying to raise $9 million to study breeding methods around this. And it does seem to be off to a good start, because within a day of this going up on Tinder, the Conservancy's website crashed. So apparently they're getting a lot of interest.
Wow. there's kind of a tragic irony there, because one of the reasons why rhinos are so hunted to extinction is for aphrodisiacs, for their horns.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but you know, any money to help on rhino research is welcome. Reverend White Hammond?
Okay, so mine's not quite as fun, although I have to go and look at this Tinder profile. So, you know, the Globe said a little bit of this week about the amount of overtime hours that police officers are working. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought immediately, you know, what is the effect on the quality if people are working so many hours? So I thought, you know, maybe this is an issue where, you know, Black Lives Matter and folks that have been frustrated might be able to actually advocate on behalf of, like, health and wellness for the police force. Maybe we need to make sure that we're not working people to the nub, because I get concerned. You work too many hours in a row. I mean, I know my quality of work goes down.
I thought you were going to say that you went out to the corner and woke up the cop who was,
who'd been on the beat for 90 hours.
Exactly. Yeah, I was just. So, you know, I do wonder. It made me, the first thing, you know, I kind of thought about is, I wonder if any of these sort of police-involved shootings or other incidents we're looking at, how many hours have those cops been up? Could the quality of their decision-making be going down because they've been spending so many hours on the job? So, you know, I don't know enough about the economics, but I think we should really think about it not just as a, like, income issue, really, but as a sort of, what is safe and what makes people allows people to make good decisions?
Absolutely important line of questioning. Mm-hmm. I think I know some good reporters who might want to start asking those questions. So my hubbub is, I nod to the fantastic Metro reporting from the Boston Globe and the venerable Frank Phillips, because he just had a great story today. I think the Globe is kind of is trolling us here with their very benign headline of "Local Man is Trump Selection," because the entire story is right there in the first paragraph. And Frank, my hat's off to you for being able to write this. Frank Phillips writes, "A Trump supporter from Braintree, whose business background includes bankruptcies, tax takings, and foreclosure notices, has been appointed to a federal job in the Small Business Administration that'll pay him more than $131,000 a year." Now, back in February, it was reported that there's some like 2,000 jobs still open in the Trump administration. So I know that they need people, but I would highly encourage the president to know that Massachusetts is actually full of very smart, great Republicans who would possibly love to work in your administration, who don't have lawsuits for cheating their employees out of their pay as part of the package. So that's my hubbub for today. Reverend Mariama White Hammond, Associate Minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Magnus.
And Charlie Chipio, Senior Fellow at the Pioneer Institute and Head of Chipio Strategies. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.